How many times have our patients returned to our office and are just stuck in the cycle of chronic inflammation? We throw everything we have at them, nothing changes, and even our dentists are frustrated. Rather than throwing our hands up and shrugging, we need to be turning to PerioTrace by PerioProtect. I have seen the evidence firsthand and have helped so many hygienists find this resource because it really works, which is why there are so many products on the market now trying to imitate them. The results are speaking for themselves, but rather than going with an unproven product, stick with the only periodontal medicine delivery system cleared by the FDA. And not only that, but their support team is seriously among the best I've ever encountered, from the education to implementation to support when there's the inevitable bumps on the road. They are there for you. If you want to get in contact with them to learn more about how you can treat your patients better, head over to perioprotect.com/RDH. And on that site, at the bottom is a contact form that you can fill out or simply email them directly to ask for help. This is one thing I truly believe should be in every dental practice. perioprotect.com/RDH to stop the cycle of chronic inflammation.
Chairside with my patients, seeing something that was at that point difficult to explain. And so I developed, first of all, the curiosity, and the curiosity leads to the question, why is this drug causing such an unusual pattern of decay that we weren't seeing with alcohol use? We weren't seeing with opioid use. I mean, it's very, very different. We need to understand that these are patients who are in our chair. Now, they may not all be addicted to methamphetamine, but we have, you know, one out of every 10 Americans has a substance use disorder. And so it's really important that we begin to recognize who these patients are. I'm seeing is failure to recognize the patient who's sitting in your dental chair. And then we develop treatment plans that we would develop just for anyone. You know, not everyone who has caries into the pole is going to be successfully treated with a root canal based upon these mitigating factors. So it allows us to really treat our patients for who they are, not just kind of one and done.
Yeah, this is a tale, oh yeah, a tale of two hygienists. So there might be only one, bringing the best of dental knowledge, and we do it all with ease. We cover oral health and screening, and preventing gum disease. We're gonna do a lot of learning, and have a little bit of fun working at the dentist. A tale of two hygienists.
Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of A Tale of Two Hygienists podcast. I am your host, Andrew Johnston. If you're a regular listener, thank you so much for coming back. But if you're a new listener to the show, man, you came to the right episode to start your journey with us. It's definitely a good one. Today is the day, everyone, and I couldn't be more excited for you to hear this amazing episode with Dr. Ronnie Brown. And I won't spoilers the episode, but it was truly phenomenal. Very, very, very great. I also ended up getting her book afterwards, which we have a link in the show notes for this episode. So if you're interested in reading her book, I highly recommend it. I love the layout. It's full of great information. It's an easy read. So even if you're not like, you don't want to sit down for, you know, a ginormous novel, that's not this. It's very easy, a great format. And I also heard after we were talking, I think we emailed back and forth a little bit afterwards, and she will be at the Chicago Midwinter meeting next year. And I know that's a long ways off, but I promised her that, you know, if she has the availability, we'll definitely do a round two and possibly a round three of this episode. But I encourage you to go out and see her live if you can. Next week, we dive deep into the nerdosphere. We welcome back guest co-host Michelle Hudson as we learn from Dr. Susan Maples, who truly is one of the most riveting people I've met. She has a magnetic personality. But she gets real sciencey in a way that's approachable, though. So I have a feeling that Dr. Maples also will be making a round two or a round three on the show at some point, because there's just so much in her brain as well. And next week is the week. It is Under One Roof. Very excited for this. We'll be doing some live podcasting from the Cellerant booth number 907, at least on Friday, quite possibly Thursday as well. But I think we're still working out some details on that one. We'll be around doing something on Thursday for sure. It just might be down one of the hallways kind of towards the end. On Saturday of RDH Under One Roof, I will be working with the Coast Dental booth. And that's going to be booth number 813. That's my day job, everyone. So We're making a huge change in the way that hygiene is being practiced. And, you know, if you have time, I'd love to tell you all about it, what we're doing differently than pretty much I've ever practiced in private practice or, you know, the organizations I've worked with before. You know, it's been crazy amazing, the growth that we've had these last several years at Coast. Unfortunately, most of my offices, though, are full up. But if you are living in Florida or you're considering moving to Florida, let me know that. And I'll tell you which offices we still have space for, you know, maybe a second or a third hygienist. And I'll introduce you to my buddy, Zach. He's the one that does all the recruiting for us. So come by and see me at either one of those places. It'd be great to see you. Maybe we'll get, you know, a picture taken or something like that. So again, thank you so much for listening to the show each week. Please head over to your podcasting app and rate and review us. And enjoy this episode with Dr. Ronnie Brown.
Tale of Two Hygienists.
Hey friends, quick pause in the show to remind you about the CE offered for several of our episodes. All you have to do is click into the show notes and follow the link to the CE Zoom website. Answer a few of those questions about the episode correctly and you'll be rewarded the appropriate amount of CEUs. This wouldn't be possible without a partnership with our friends at TempStars. TempStars is more than just a temp and a placement service. They are clinician-led and education-focused and strive to perfectly match individuals and dental offices. Learn more about TempStars.com or go back and listen to some of their tip episodes. They are absolutely worth the listen. And now, back to the show. All right, welcome in everyone to the interview portion of the podcast. I'm really happy to be joined by Dr. Ronnie Brown. Doctor, thank you so much for taking time this morning.
Oh, you're welcome. It's great to be on the podcast. Thank you.
I am really intrigued by this. We've done, I think, close to probably 700 episodes over the 7 years of just various different things. And I don't think that we've ever covered in the depth, hopefully, that we'll cover today, addiction, substance abuse, but also meth mouth specifically. We've never touched that. That's not, do you find that that's a pretty, like there's lots of speakers that speak about it?
You know, there have increased definitely over the period of time. But, you know, Andrew, it's such a important and relevant topic right now as we are still in the midst of a pandemic. We're dealing with increase in mental health issues and we're looking at, you know, our overdose death numbers increasing. It's probably one of the most relevant and one of the most important issues to address currently in dentistry.
Yeah, I mean, I would absolutely agree with that. We had, you know, in school, we always had the chapter. Well, it's the subset in the chapter, right? Of this is what it is. But, you know, I feel like it's really hard to find quote unquote experts on this. And so I'm really fascinated to know kind of what, tell me more about your background and kind of what led you into all of this.
Okay. Well, definitely wasn't my idea when I was sitting in dental school at UCLA that one day I'm going to be that meth mouth girl. But, you know, a couple things in terms of my background. As a dental student, definitely had a passion for public health. And when I graduated from dental school, I did a residency. And then a few years later, I began working at a medium security detention facility in Northern California. Now, once again, wasn't what I was thinking of when I was a dental student at UCLA, but it definitely provided me with that opportunity to get into a public health realm. Mm-hmm. And I started working at the jail in 1997, so 25 years ago. And it's kind of interesting because even though it was 25 years ago, I still remember my very first patient on my very first day of work. And when he opened his mouth, he was about 20 years old. He was in a lot of dental pain. And when he opened his mouth, you know, as unprofessional as it can be, I literally gasped because I couldn't believe what I was seeing. I was seeing a mouth that was just devastated. I was seeing teeth that were blackened and broken. Enamel that was so demineralized appeared to be crumbling. And based upon what I learned in dental school, I assumed that this may have been due to a sweetened diet, may have been due to poor oral hygiene, maybe even due to poverty. And so I remember scolding my patient and telling him, you need to do a better job taking care of your teeth. And I developed a treatment plan, including multiple extractions, and I scheduled him to return. And I was kind of like, one and done. That was my first patient. Great job. And then the next patient came in. And once again, I gasped. Similar presentation of decay. And this was reoccurring, you know, patient after patient after patient. And after seeing this for about a month or so and trying to apply the paradigm that I'd learned in dental school about caries epidemiology, I realized that this was different. I was seeing something that I had not been trained to see. I knew it was decay, but it looked different. And so I began to ask my patients, you know, what are you putting in your mouth? Because that's a question that we often ask our patients, you know, tell me about your diet. And I also asked, why do you think you have so many cavities? And, you know, such a young population with this rampant, generalized, advanced caries presentation. And I assume my patients would say, oh, they're, you know, maybe I'm doing some energy drinks plus some Mountain Dew. But my patients were saying, no, I use methamphetamine. And back in 1997, Andrew, literally, I had no idea what that was. I really thought they must be going to a GNC store. It's a weird nutritional supplement. But as they were describing it, I began to realize that they were talking about a very powerful, a very addictive central nervous system stimulant. And so that got me on the path of curiosity, because back in 1997, I couldn't go to the Journal of the American Dental Association or the Journal of the California Dental Association and find articles that really talked about this drug and specifically why it was creating such an unusual presentation of decay.
No, go ahead. This is absolutely fascinating. So, but I do, I'm really hoping that you are going to kind of go into like what happens of why is it, how is this different than, you know, the sugars and the bacteria kind of decay?
Yeah. So to answer that question, you know, for the first basically maybe 10 years of working at the jail and the absence of really well-designed research studies, there were a lot of pilot studies that were being published, a lot of kind of anecdotal reports, I began to utilize my patient population by just peppering them with questions. You know, why do you use this drug? Where do you get this drug? How much does this drug cost? How does this drug make you feel? And surprisingly, my patients were really my first source of information. And so I gained a lot of comfort about having really frank conversations with patients about their addiction and specifically their addiction to methamphetamine. And in doing so, I began to also develop some hypotheses about how they were using the drug that was creating this unique pattern of decay. Because I'd have some patients who use methamphetamine and you would never know. And then I'd have other patients who use methamphetamine and every tooth in their mouth needed to be extracted. So 10 years after kind of, I would say, just maybe qualitative research, kind of focus-based questions, I went back to school to get my master's degree in public health. And I knew that when I walked into the door of my master's program, that I was going to walk out of the door as an expert on meth mouth, because I was going to do my research on it and I was going to get published. And so I developed at that time one of the largest research studies, and I specifically investigated the impact of drug use patterns on meth mouth severity, looking at specifically oral route of administration through smoking, intravenous, intranasal, as well as other drug use patterns, duration of use, amount of use, frequency of use, co-abuse with alcohol, to determine which of these drug use patterns were a more significant predictor of meth mouth severity. And so that kind of, I think, kind of got me into the realm of putting myself on the map, probably as that meth mouth girl, and beginning to speak both nationally and internationally on the topic.
Doctor, this is incredible. The little LinkedIn message that we had back and forth, I never knew. Okay, can we talk a little bit more about the research part of it?
Yes.
Because I feel like research, for dental hygienists out there, research is something that is usually given to us. It's not something that we participate in often. Now, there are plenty of amazing hygienists that do participate in. I just want to qualify that. But can you talk to me about, you know, what are the things that go into, you know, the validity of the research that you're doing? Because it sounds like there's a lot of, like, just questions and things that are being asked.
Well, I always think it starts with the curiosity. You know, once again, I was chair-side with my patients, seeing something that was at that point difficult to explain. And so I developed, first of all, the curiosity. And the curiosity leads to the question, why is this drug causing such an unusual pattern of decay that we weren't seeing with alcohol use? We weren't seeing with opioid use. I mean, it's very, very different. And so that curiosity led me to start just asking my patients questions, started me going into research to see if I could pull together what was already known about it. So the first thing is it starts with a question, and then that question is going to lead you into the research so you understand what is already known about this and what has yet to be discovered. And what had yet to be discovered was really the pattern of use. And so that's, and then that created conversations with my patients. How are you using this drug? And I started to see that those who were smoking the drug, who were orally administering the drug, had a more distinct and devastating pattern of decay than those who are bypassing the oral cavity through intranasal or intravenous use. And I think intuitively that makes sense, but until you actually apply research and quantitative methodology to it, it's just a hypothesis.
Sure.
And so when I went into my master's program, I'm now with a group of well-vested researchers who are able to help guide me in the process. So it was, you know, working with the jail in terms of a memorandum of understanding, getting an institutional review board to make sure that because I was working with a vulnerable population, we weren't violating things from an ethical perspective, developing both a question set, you know, in terms of asking our participants about some basic demographic information, frequency of dental utilization, oral hygiene practices, and then specifically developing a list of questions about their pattern of use, and then doing a clinical evaluation for each patient and developing that clinical portion of the research where we were then basically examining patients and looking at basic indices for dental decay, the DMFT, decayed, missing, and filled teeth, and then quantifying that. And then on the back end with all the statistical analysis and really looking at, of all the data that we had accumulated, what was the most relevant data? And then it starts, your data starts leading the story. And so that's a little bit of that process.
So with this pattern of use, is there a correlation between the pattern of use and addiction?
So, you know, really good question. We didn't specifically investigate that. We were looking at pattern of use as it related to what we define as meth mouth severity, the number of teeth that were decayed that could be really kind of linked to their use of methamphetamine. Mm-hmm. But clearly there are some hallmarks to severity of addiction, right? Mm-hmm. Duration of use. The more time someone is using a drug that's addictive, the greater the risk and the likelihood that they will develop an addiction to a drug, right? So duration of use, really, when you look at just kind of the disease model of addiction, will be a hallmark for someone moving very quickly from abuse dependency to that point of addiction.
I apologize. I know nothing about methamphetamines and methamphetamine use. I'm so sorry. But is there a way that someone could be a meth user and not be addicted? Does that happen?
So why don't we start off with a few definitions so that we're kind of create maybe for the viewership kind of a foundational understanding.
Absolutely. Thank
okay.
you.
So first of all, addiction, probably the most widely accepted definition of addiction, comes from the National Institute on Drug Abuse, and it defines addiction as a chronic, progressive, relapsing brain disorder characterized by compulsive drug use, drug craving, despite adverse consequences. And it causes functional changes in the part of the brain that's responsible for self-control, reward, and stress. So the most important part of that definition is a brain disorder. The second most important part is a progressive brain disorder, meaning that it moves through stages. So the first thing that happens before someone becomes addicted is they're abusing the drug. They're abusing a drug that produces pleasure, that gets them high. It's the individual who might be dabbling in, I'm going to take a few extra Valium, even though I was only prescribed to take one before bedtime, I'm taking four or five throughout the day because I like the way it's making me feel. And so that's abuse. As the abuse continues, the second stage is dependency, where now I've developed a physical and psychological requirement for this drug, meaning that in order to feel normal, in order to function, this drug has to be in my system because I can't function or feel normal without the drug. And when I don't have the drug in the system, I will then go through withdrawal. So dependency is the second stage where someone actually requires this drug to be able to function. As the dependency continues, the third stage is addiction, where now it's this degree of compulsiveness, where everything I think about, how I feel, what I do, is everything centered around the drug. I wake up and I'm trying to get the drug in my system. I go throughout the day and I need to maintain that level of high. And at that point of addiction, you've really created some significant changes in the brain, some significant neurochemical changes in the brain that quite frankly are irreversible. So every drug has its own pathway. Some drugs can go from abuse to addiction very quickly for an individual, but also it's not just the drug itself, it's the individual. Is there a genetic predisposition for addiction? Has that individual inherited genes that alter how one metabolizes the drug? Is this a drug being abused by a teenager who has a underdeveloped prefrontal cortex or has a mesolimbic region of the brain that's not fully functional? Are there environmental factors, whether it's a history of abuse, family issues? So there's a lot of other mitigating factors, right? Because it's a disease like diabetes, genetic, environmental, and biologic.
So quick question. This is going to be a very side tangent. Are there genetic markers that can be tested for like meth addiction, kind of like alcoholism and other things?
So good question. I don't know if I completely have the answer. So I kind of want to say I don't know. However, there are markers that will assist with the development of understanding kind of metabolism. One's ability, have I inherited a gene that's altering my ability to metabolize or slow the metabolism of a drug, meaning that that drug stays in the system for a longer period of time? Now, I don't know if there's a specific marker for methamphetamine, and that's a really great question, but there are markers for cocaine. There's markers for alcohol. So great question. Probably a question for a neurochemist.
So, let's travel down this little hypothesis just a little bit longer, if you don't mind. So if the drug isn't being metabolized in your body, do you still have the effects of maybe being high longer? Or is it just more at that point getting to a systemic toxicity issue?
Well, definitely the drug is not being metabolized as rapidly. So it's staying in the system for a longer period of time. And as it stays in the system for a longer period of time, one of the main neurochemicals that all drugs that are addictive impact is dopamine. And dopamine is a neurochemical that produces a feeling of pleasure. And so if you have a drug in the system for a prolonged period of time, its ability to continually stimulate the dopamine receptors and create that release of dopamine is going to allow for a more prolonged high, a more profound high, and a high that you're always chasing because it's so intense.
Well, thank you for indulging me going down these little rabbit holes. This is the podcast right here, everyone. So I want to talk about, most of the people that listen to the podcast are clinicians. They're active clinicians. We're going to see this in our chair. And so just quickly, if we could go through maybe it's like signs and symptoms, whether it's, early stages or whether it's, obvious, rampant decay and things like that. What can we expect? And then I want to talk about the meth mouth treatment plan assessment form.
Okay, so a couple things. It's really important, and the message that I really want to deliver is that these are patients in our dental chairs. And it's really important because I think we want to always assume it's the practice is on the other side of the railroad tracks, it's the practice in a very urban setting, it's always somewhere else. But the reality is when we have 23.5 million Americans with substance use disorders, we've got methamphetamine being the second most widely abused drug in the world, with roughly 2 million Americans over the age of 12 reporting past year use of the drug. When we have methamphetamine being the second leading cause of drug overdose deaths in this country, second to opioids, but number one as a leading cause of drug overdose deaths in many Western states, we need to understand that these are patients who are in our chair. Now, they may not all be addicted to methamphetamine, but we have, one out of every 10 Americans has a substance use disorder. And so it's really important that we begin to recognize who these patients are. Now, specifically as it relates to methamphetamine, and I'm going to do a very quick crash course because in order to recognize a patient, it's not just looking at their teeth, which is definitely one of the hallmark, but also understanding a little bit about the pharmacology because the pharmacology explains everything. All right, so I'm just going to do a quick pharm lesson tying it into the physical, behavioral, and oral manifestations. Is that okay?
Love it. Okay. Yes, please.
So dopamine is the first neurochemical that is the primary impact that methamphetamine has, a neurochemical that communicates pleasure. Dopamine also not only creates pleasure, but creates a high degree of sociability. So when someone is high on methamphetamine and they've got a lot of dopamine in their system, it's going to be the patient who comes into your office super confident, over the top, the life of the party, because they've got so much dopamine floating through their brain. But the other thing that happens when you have high levels of dopamine is it actually stimulates the alpha-2 receptors in the sympathetic nervous system, causing vasoconstriction, and it causes hyposalivation. So this will also be the patient who presents with a very dry mouth. About 85% of meth users report a very dry mouth during their meth use. So that's something to look out for. You also, with the high levels of dopamine, not only is it decreasing salivary flow, but methamphetamine is a really acidic drug. So you have a decrease in salivary flow at a point that something very acidic is in the oral environment. So it causes rapid enamel demineralization and a very low salivary pH. And it's that low salivary pH that is going to then kind of spiral into kind of this decay pattern that you see. Okay, so that's number one. Number two, methamphetamine impacts the sympathetic nervous system, impacting both epinephrine and norepinephrine, causing epinephrine and norepinephrine to remain present for an extended period of time. So we all are familiar with epinephrine, right? It's part of our fight or flight reaction. But when you have a lot of epinephrine floating around your system, you're going to be super energetic, right? And so someone who walks into your practice high in methamphetamine is going to be off the chain, physically hyperactive, behaviorally hyperactive, rapid speech pattern, but the increase in epinephrine will cause increases in vital signs. So when you're taking your blood pressure, you're going to see increases in blood pressure, increases in pulse. You'll see pupils that are dilated. So have your patients take off their sunglasses and look into your patient's eyes. Norepinephrine, which is the other part of the sympathetic nervous system, regulates our sleep-wake cycle and our level of arousal. So, and causes obsessive-compulsive behavior. So this is going to be a person who looks fatigued because they've been up all night. Sometimes they're up for days because norepinephrine will cause them to have long bouts of wakefulness. Also, they're fixated on doing like repetitive tasks. So they're like fidgeting. They're restacking the cups on the countertop. They're reorganizing your magazines on the coffee table because it's giving them this false sense of productivity.
Right.
Serotonin is a fourth neurochemical, and methamphetamine blocks the release of serotonin, causing very low levels of serotonin. Serotonin is a mood stabilizer. So when someone is high in methamphetamine, their moods are deregulated. They become very anxious. And sometimes it's the dental patient whose anxiety really is not matching the clinical scenario. They can become very paranoid because of the low levels of serotonin. So their behavior becomes very erratic and become very violent. So those are just kind of some behavioral manifestations, but specifically orally, you're going to have that low salivary pH. You're going to see enamel that's demineralized. You're going to see a lot of white spot lesions. Mm-hmm. If they're smoking methamphetamine, a drug that consists of battery acid, lantern fuel, lithium batteries, and they're smoking it, all that acidity and the corrosiveness is coming into their oral environment. So that smoke is going to create a chemical burn on the enamel because it's so acidic. And so you see caries that's blackened. You see that blackened decay on anterior teeth because that's where the smoke is coming into and contacting. You'll see infrequent brushing, so really high plaque level. And if you think about it, you're not brushing, you're not flossing. Plaque being retained cervically and interproximally is going to lead to then class 3 and class 5 lesions. So you see a lot of class 5 lesions, typically in a relatively young patient, which once again doesn't make sense. So those are some of the just overall very quick synopsis of what you need to look out for.
And then when you're using your treatment plan assessment form, are a lot of those on that, or are you looking at different indicators?
So absolutely. So I developed a meth mouth treatment plan assessment form to really assist the clinician, the dentist, the hygienist in developing realistic treatment plans. And it's really based upon that Canberra format, you know, caries management by risk assessment, where in order to successfully treat caries, you have to first assign a risk level to the patient and then develop specific and targeted interventions at that risk level with the goal that over time, your surgical, your restorative, your preventive strategies targeted at that risk level will decrease your patient's future risk for caries. And what's really missing in that Canberra assessment is looking at substance use as a risk indicator for caries. And so I incorporated that into the development of the form. And so now it's, before you jump into a treatment plan, it's about asking your patient about years of use of meth. How long have you used it? Are you currently using? Are you co-abusing with other drugs that also might have a hyposalivatory effect? Are, what's your diet like? Is it, you know, consuming a lot of sweetened food and beverages? What is your utilization of dental services over the last year? Are you brushing and flossing your teeth? And then clinically looking for signs of enamel demineralization, white spot lesions, which is a risk for caries, looking at the presence of heavy visible plaque, which we know is statistically related to caries development, looking at the percentage of teeth that are decayed, as well as the presence of caries that involves the pulp. And so I have it set up like a signal light. Red is high risk, yellow is medium risk, green is low risk. And you basically, as you're interviewing and doing your clinical examination, you're checking off these factors, and whatever column has the most check marks will be the assigned risk level for the patient. Once that risk is known, you then are ready to develop preventive, restorative, and surgical strategies aimed at that level of risk. And this form helps to guide you into understanding if someone's at a high risk. This is a patient you want to prescribe that 5,000 part per million fluoridate toothpaste. Make them a custom tray where they can put that fluoride in, have a prolonged presence. This is a patient that you want to have more frequent hygiene visits with, and for the dentist, more periodic oral exams. You want to, in a high risk category, this is not the implant case, but this might be the denture case, because what I'm seeing is failure to recognize the patient who's sitting in your dental chair. And then we develop treatment plans that we would develop just for anyone. You know, not everyone who has caries into the pulp is going to be successfully treated with a root canal based upon these mitigating factors. So it allows us to really treat our patients for who they are, not just kind of one and done.
Yeah, I love that. So quick question about that. So, you know, I fill out my Canberra form, my traditional Canberra form, I should say. You know, I'm going to be moderate or high caries risk patient. And then I have, I guess, a modifier or an additional, an elevating risk factor here if they are using substance use at all for meth. And are there, in addition to the 5,000 parts per million fluoride, is there anything from a prevention standpoint that we need to do differently than the high caries risk? Or is this mostly going to impact, like you said, like our surgical treatment planning or our restorative materials treatment planning?
I think really all of it, the form is really pretty comprehensive. And I want to just make sure that this form is available for free. Anyone can just either go onto my website, which is www.drronniebrown.com, or they can text the words "a state of decay" to 22828. Once again, "a state of decay" to 22828. And in the treatment plan assessment form, Andrew, there are things that the hygienist absolutely needs to do. You know, it's once again, more frequent dental hygiene visits, seeing these patients, you know, every 3 to 4 months versus saying, oh, I'll see you in 6 months. It's thinking about how to address that hyposalivation. So bringing to the attention of the dentist, is this a patient that we need to recommend a biotin product to, or a dry mouth spray, or do we need to prescribe pilocarpine or, you know, Salogen? We need to go over oral hygiene instructions. The majority of individuals who use methamphetamine report almost never brushing their teeth. So we need to actually sit down with them and provide them with those oral hygiene instructions. From the restorative aspect, these are patients that have such high caries rates that we want to think about, you know, direct restorations so that we can move through the dentition much faster. We need to think about utilizing glass ionomer, which is releasing fluoride. We want to remember high risk means high chance for failure. So you want to simplify treatment plans for success because complex treatment plans will lead to failure. But as you move that patient into a lower risk category and you see that your strategies are working, you can then consider more complex treatment. But once again, we've got to remember, who is that patient who is sitting in our dental chair? And when they have an addiction, whether it's to heroin, to methamphetamine, to cocaine, to alcohol, they are dealing with one of the most challenging disease processes. And we have to be respectful of that. We have to be mindful of that. But the most important thing is to make sure that we, regardless of the drug that they're using, our role as dental care professionals is obviously to do no harm, to do good by developing treatment plans that can be successful, and also to be ethical and to refer these patients, like you would refer to the endodontist, you'd refer to the periodontist, refer these patients to resources that can help get them on a pathway to recovery or a pathway to help maintain their sobriety. And I want to make sure, Andrew, that I just give for your audience just a toll-free number that they could write down and give to their patient. That's our responsibility. And that number is 1-800-662-HELP. 1-800-662-HELP, toll-free number by the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Service Administration.
Love this. Dr. Brownlee, this has really been fantastic. I know this went by way too fast. We're definitely going to have you come back on again. I have several more questions for you for the next episode. But I also want people to go out and find you when you're doing your, you know, your webinars and your lecturing and things like that. You have a book as well. Tell us all about where people can find you and what else they can do to, you know, to follow you and support you.
Well, definitely. Thank you again so much, Andrew, for inviting me to be on the podcast. So definitely have a lot of resources on my website, which is drronniebrown.com. And there's no E in my name. It's R-O-N-N-I Brown. A lot of resources. You can get the meth mouth treatment plan assessment form. I've got office policies for addressing a patient who might be under the influence in your practice, health history forms that ask questions about substance use disorders. My book is called A State of Decay, Your Dental Guide to Understanding and Treating Meth Mouth, and it is available on Amazon. It's a great resource, a great elf on the shelf when you're wanting to remember how to have those conversations or what to look out for from a physical, behavioral, oral perspective and some treatment planning solutions. It's almost reads as our conversation today. It's very conversational. It's an easy read, but I think it makes a very important and difficult topic digestible, understandable, and impactful for dental care professionals.
Love that. That sounds like a good gift idea for doctor coming up here in December. So, and so thank you so much again for being here. We're definitely going to have you back on. Everyone, there's links in the show notes for all of the things that Dr. Brown was talking about if you wanted to check it out. Thank you again, doctor. Have a good day.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Yeah, this is a tale, oh yeah. A tale of two hygienists. So there might be only one, bringing the best of dental knowledge, and we do it all with ease. We cover oral health and screening and preventing gum disease. We're gonna do a lot of learning and have a little bit of fun working at the dentist. A tale of two hygienists.